Ratzinger is a literalist, and I think that's problematic in terms of how you deal with things and how you deal pastorally with people. Do you deal with people by the law or with the heart? We need to have a Roman Catholic Church with the heart.
The priest is incredibly reluctant, incredibly so, and Fergal really kind of is, he's the one that's definitely pursuing and trying to seduce this man, and he finally succeeds, thank goodness.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. British queers breathe easier with Labour's victory, a former Jesuit priest discusses the last pope and a Ratzinger future, and a popular Irish singer challenges assumptions with the arrival of Fergal Flynn. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending May 7th, 2005. Elections in Britain this week gave a third term to Labour and Prime Minister Tony Blair, but with a drastically reduced majority in the Parliament that will make it hard to advance legislation. While Labour has presided over a number of major advances towards equality of lesbian gays, most of the seats it lost went to the even more gay-supportive Liberal Democrats and Greens, parties which officially endorse marriage equality. There was only a small gain for the Conservative Party, which remains a refuge for homophobes despite its efforts to become more inclusive. Overall, in the view of veteran activist Peter Tatchell of Outrage, this is a good result for gay rights. For the first time ever, an openly gay non-incumbent Conservative candidate was elected to the Parliament, and by a landslide margin. He's Nick Herbert, the director of the Conservative think tank Reform, and he'll be representing the safe Tory constituency of Arundel and South Downs. Tory MP Alan Duncan, who publicly identified himself as a gay man after he'd taken office, was returned to Parliament by his Rutland and Melton constituents. Seven other openly gay MPs and the Parliament's lone open lesbian, Angela Eagle, were re-elected. But Minister of State for Education Stephen Twigg was ousted by Tory David Burrows, who emphasized his Christian beliefs in his campaign. Twigg's 1997 upset victory as an openly gay first-time candidate over Tory powerhouse Michael Portillo had stood as the emblem of the so-called Labour Revolution that ended the Conservatives' long reign.
With the very real possibility of a snap election looming in Canada as the opposition Conservative Party promises a no-confidence vote for the scandal-ridden Liberal Party's minority government, the future of that government's bill for marriage equality is in doubt. But this week, it passed its second reading in Parliament with a 54% majority. While most of the Bloc Québécois and New Democratic Party MPs and four Conservatives joined the government, 35 members of the ruling Liberal Party voted with the Conservatives to oppose it. The bill is now in the hands of a special committee, and at its first meeting this week, that group gave serious consideration to a condensed schedule that could return it to the floor in as little as 2 weeks. While some Conservatives want an extended hearing process, some observers believe that party is ready to drop its stalling tactics in order to use MPs' final votes on the bill in campaigning. But some dissenting Liberals are also calling for expanded deliberations, despite a commission having previously spent 6 months touring Canada for public consultation on the issue. But to survive the fall of the government, the bill would have to be completely enacted, including royal assent, and although its prospects for a timely passage by the Parliament are looking a little brighter, the government has not arranged for it to be expedited in the Senate, as the budget bill will be.
The Norwegian Conservative Party is currently struggling with its position on opening marriage to same-gender couples. Activists are lobbying party leaders for an official statement of support from the party's upcoming national convention. But this week, the Dagsavisen newspaper reported that the Conservatives' leader on the Finnmark County Council and former Central Steering Committee member Birger Westland fired back an email declaring, "This idea about a sexually neutral marriage law is some of the biggest nonsense anyone has come up with. We politicians can't use much time on some people who are disturbed in their heads and like people of the same sex. Go to a psychologist." Westland confirmed to the Afton Post and newspaper that he believes marriage equality is a lot of rubbish. This is definitely out of line with the party's position, and reactions within the party have ranged from calls for Westland to apologize to demands for his ouster from the party. Norway has long had registered partnerships for gay and lesbian couples with legal status very nearly equivalent to marriage. But even though former conservative party head and current Norwegian finance minister Per Christian Foss has registered his own gay partnership, he reportedly has some doubts about supporting marriage equality.
New Zealand's parliament will be taking up a private members' bill to deny marriage to gay and lesbian couples, even as some of those couples are contracting the nation's new civil unions. The Marriage Gender Clarification Amendment Bill, proposed by Larry Baldock of the right-wing United Future Party, was drawn for debate in the coming week. The ruling Labour Party and the National Party will be determining their stances in caucus sessions in the coming week, but the Greens readily denounced it as an attempt to legislate for discrimination and homophobia. This week also marked the first major public celebration of a civil union since the legislation became effective last week. Wellington Mayor Carrie Prendergast presided before more than 200 people in city council chambers decked with rainbow flags and balloons as vows were exchanged by Des Smith and John Jolliffe. The couple of 19 years are known as the poster boys of civil unions for their advocacy and lobbying for the bills. With a piper in tights, a color guard of rainbow flags, and a brass band, the entire party paraded through the civic square, joined by at least 50 more along the way.
The president of the Navajo Nation this week vetoed a ban on gay and lesbian marriages, overriding a unanimous vote by the Navajo Nation Council last month. Joe Shirley Jr. said, "Same-sex marriage is a non-issue on Navajo land, so why waste time and resources on it? We have more important issues to address." He added that the bill would generate feelings of disharmony and disunity among the Navajo people and veil the discriminatory aspect in the guise of family values. He felt that the measure's stated goal of family stability would be better served by dealing with issues such as family violence.
In the U.S. state of Georgia, Governor Sonny Perdue this week signed into law two Republican-sponsored bills designed to block gay supportive policies of the city of Atlanta. One bars local governments from giving any consideration to employee wages and benefits offered by companies bidding for public contracts, the second round in the state's battle against Atlanta moves to favor bidders offering spousal benefits to domestic partners. The second law bars state and local governments from in any way penalizing an organization or person for a choice whether or not to extend to unmarried people the same treatment offered legally married couples. That was intended to stop the city from fining the Druid Hills Golf Club for violating its civil rights ordinance by refusing spousal membership benefits to gay and lesbian couples, a high-profile situation that generated a tangle of lawsuits and which may not actually be resolved by the language of the new law.
The state of Colorado may become the 17th in the U.S. to prohibit employment discrimination based on sexual orientation, with the legislature's final approval of a bill this week. The House voted 60% in favor of the bill, and then the Senate voted to concur with House changes to the bill. Initial Senate approval had come by a one-vote margin. The big question mark is Governor Bill Owens, a Republican who has not yet taken a position on the bill, despite his party's lawmakers' vigorous opposition to it. He is being actively lobbied by conservatives to veto it. His signature would also make Colorado the sixth U.S. state to prohibit employment discrimination based on gender identity. A civil rights law in Colorado would be particularly sweet for activists, since it's the only state whose voters once approved a state constitutional amendment prohibiting cities and counties from enacting any such protections for lesbian gays. That notorious Amendment 2 was ultimately struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. Also this week in Colorado, a proposed constitutional amendment to deny marriage to gay and lesbian couples was killed by a House committee by a one-vote margin.
And finally, the state of Washington's latest attempt to make sexual orientation a category protected under its civil rights law was defeated by a single vote as it reached the Senate floor for the first time late last month. Bitterly disappointed despite 30 years of similar defeats, many activists blame the loss on software giant Microsoft, which had backed off from its longtime support of the bill to a neutral position. There was a particular sense of betrayal because Microsoft had been a pioneer in equal treatment policies for its own lesbian gay employees. The corporate line was that the change was part of a general decision to restrict lobbying efforts to measures directly affecting its business, but a local anti-gay evangelist was quick to claim credit since the change followed his meeting with management, at least chronologically. Microsoft's lesbi-gay employee group Gleam protested vigorously, and its secretary-treasurer Jeff Kurtzen actually gave notice he was leaving his job. This week, in the face of continuing national reporting and protest, Microsoft Chief Executive Steve Ballmer announced, "After looking at the question from all sides, I've concluded that diversity in the workplace is such an important issue for our business that it should be included in our legislative agenda."
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 7th, 2005, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
You'll hear from the author of a controversial novel about the relationship between a Belfast teenager and his handsome young parish priest. Await the arrival of Fergal Flynn later in the program.
I will offer my opinions. I don't think anyone can really predict what's going to happen.
Reverend Dr. Bob Goss heads the Metropolitan Community Church of the Valley, one of hundreds of predominantly queer churches of the Universal Fellowship of Metropolitan Community Churches. He's also a former Jesuit priest. As the Roman Catholic cardinals were considering who would be the next pope late last month, Goss had some thoughts about the eventual choice, German Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, as well as the legacy of Pope John Paul II.
What is really significant is the fact that the pope carries a great deal of power and weight in political capital. John Paul II's popularity was worldwide, but also many Catholics would say, "I love John Paul II, but I don't agree with him on birth control, and I don't practice." And I think that is an amazing sort of differentiation that we find of Catholic consciousness, not only in the United States, but around the world. John Paul did some very damaging things. I want to say he did some very damaging things to the Jesuits. In the early 1980s, he put it into a receivership to really teach the Jesuits to comply with obedience. He's also done incredible things with the Vatican bureaucracy, which was run by the religious orders, the Dominicans, Franciscans, Jesuits, and Benedictines. He replaced them with Opus Dei. Opus Dei was founded in Spain, in fascist Spain, in the 1930s. If you read the Da Vinci Code, and the assassin is an Opus Dei, that was probably the most credible piece of information in the Da Vinci Code. They're radical fanatics. And the moderating influence of religious orders has been taken away in the Vatican bureaucracy. That's going to have a long-standing impact. The second thing is that he eliminated liberation theology, really stamped it out. And one of the things I have a hard time reconciling is one of the people I really admire was Oscar Romero, who was martyred in San Salvador because he stood with the people. All sorts of influence was pulled away from him by John Paul II, again, because he identified with the people and liberation movements. And I have problems with that. John Paul was a great man in terms of dealing with the issues in the Soviet Union and the Communist bloc, and was instrumental for bringing that down. And I certainly agree with him on the war in Iraq and capital punishment. We agreed together. But when it comes to the issues around women, sexuality, and the sexual abuse issues of the clergy, I have difficulties with what he's done.
Germany's Joseph Ratzinger, the man selected to be the next pope, was for more than two decades head of the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, formerly known as the Inquisition. Ratzinger was the active enforcer of conformity to tradition and the actual author of much of the anti-gay rhetoric of John Paul II's reign.
In the 1980s, Cardinal Ratzinger wrote a letter to the American bishops on homosexuals, characterizing us as intrinsically evil and objectively disordered, and arguing against us and giving any sort of rights. He followed up in 1992 with another letter comparing us to mentally ill folks that needed to be restrained from positions of teaching and any sort of public rights. This guy is dangerous. Now, Ratzinger was a good theologian in the 1960s. He was considered to be a liberal, pro-Vatican II. But once he got into the position of cardinal, he was co-opted by the power. Ratzinger is a literalist. Just as the American cardinals are literalists in terms of interpreting the law, it has to be this way. And I think that it is a form of fundamentalism, Catholicism. It really is. It's a literalist. And I think that's That is problematic in terms of how you deal with things and how you deal pastorally with people. Do you deal with people viewed by the law or with the heart? We need to have a Roman Catholic Church with a heart.
If there's something to be learned from examining the past, it's that institutions change, or else they do not last. Now you are such a dinosaur in the ancient ways you think, and if you do not soon adapt, you too will be extinct. I believe that Christ's intention many centuries ago was to serve and to enlighten and to guide our spiritual growth. But the latest word from Rome is not a loving one at all. If Jesus walked on earth today, I think he'd be appalled. You say that gays and lesbians have fallen from God's grace, and tacitly you sanction all the violence that we face. You distort the Bible's words to support your platitudes. But bigotry is not a very Christian attitude. Now as for Reformation, I very little hope. But if you think it can be done, go and tell it to the Pope. 'Cause the clergy and parishioners who are still inside the closet support this persecution, even if they do not cause it.
That was MCC of the Valley's Reverend Dr. Bob Goss and Romanofsky and Phillips with Him.
Hey, this is Hal Sparks, TV's Michael from Queer as Folk, and you're listening to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine, and good for you! Good for you!
Brian Kennedy is a very popular and openly gay singer in and out of his native Ireland. His debut novel, The Arrival of Fergal Flynn, sold 10,000 copies in its first week there. It's a fictional story, but grounded in Brian's own experience as a young man in early 80s Belfast, growing up in an abusive family amidst the poverty and violence generated by the occupying British forces. The great attribute Brian shares with his novel's 16-going-on-17-year-old Fergal is a naturally beautiful voice. When handsome 27-year-old Father Mac arrives in the parish, Fergal discovers his sexuality, his talent for singing, and the wonderful opportunities the world has to offer. This Way Out correspondent John Frame chats with Kennedy about what could be a controversial story.
We meet Fergal, he's 16 and a half, he's in his final year of school, and at that point where he's not sure what he's going to do next, really. He also happens to live in West Belfast in the early 80s, when it was probably at its most
turbulent in terms of the things that had gone on, and the war was still raging on outside on the street. Fergal is one of four children, he's the middle child. He has twin sports-obsessed older brothers and a younger brother who's similarly obsessed. He lives with a very strange set of parents. His father's, again, a big sportsman, very violent, typical kind of drinking, kind of silent man with a bonfire burning underneath his skin all the time by his behaviour anyway. And his mother, again, is basically doing the best she can, but she has her own problems compounded with her Valium intake and how difficult life is, you know, and lack of education, lack of all this kind of stuff. So he's got this real love-hate relationship with his mother particularly, and also his grandmother, who's the other powerful woman in his life that he ends up living with very briefly. And just when you thought it couldn't get any worse and there was no light at the end of the tunnel, Enter our hero, really, which is in the shape of this 27-year-old priest who's just arrived back. He's an Irish man, but arrives back from Africa after 5 years at the missions. And he's the first person that is kind to Fergal, and he becomes his saviour. But not only that, Fergal develops a massive crush on him, and they end up having a very unusual relationship for two people like that growing up around the Falls Road. And they embark on this love affair. But it's important to point out at this point that the priest is incredibly reluctant, incredibly so. And Fergal really kind of is, he's the one that's definitely pursuing and trying to seduce this man. And he finally succeeds, thank goodness. But the thing, the glue that keeps them together is also Fergal's singing voice and the priest's interest in music and performing and teaching Fergal how to be a better singer. And that's where their friendship, that's the foundation of the friendship. And then it develops into love.
And you're not writing it just from the point of view of Fergal. It's good that we look inside the head of Dermot McManus, the priest.
Yes, indeed.
And so he shares the fact that he knows that these are things he shouldn't be allowing himself to respond to, no matter how much this young person is expressing attraction, desire,
yes,
to him.
Yes.
Part of his job is to say, no, I won't act on that.
Yes, exactly. And so it was important to allow that to happen, because it's much more honest, and not peddle this notion of the paedophilic priest who's just picking on his next victim. You know, this priest, although he's 27, he does have kind of still quite a young attitude towards things. He's also still a bit naive. And also he's been, although he's had a little bit of a history, shall we say, in Africa, which we briefly touch on, Fergal is also the first person that really rocks the foundations of his faith. And we look at what a struggle Dermot has with that. But ultimately, because it's about love, then that's the thing that wins through. I mean, it was also important, of course, to write about the sexual interest and the sexual part of their relationship and how that comes to be and how explorative it is and how naive it is in terms of their own experience of each other. And I wanted to write something like that because ultimately, of course, I think it's beautiful what happens between these two people. And it's also honest. I wanted to honestly report what it's like for a 16-and-a-half, 17-year-old person to fancy a man and to actually get to that point where they end up being intimate with each other and how extraordinary that is. I don't know if anybody's listening who remembers their very first time. I suspect most people do. And how exciting it is to finally stop thinking about that stuff and actually do it. And the world makes sense for a second, anyway.
Yep. Brutality within families. It's often, it's generational.
Mm-hmm. Hey?
So it really is quite a struggle for Fergal to break away from that cycle of violence.
It is a minor miracle, really. But I think that the ultimate lesson in this is that with any aspect of life, anything significant that happens to you usually is hard won, and you have to take risks in your life if things are going to change. The voice is the thing that saves him, because he can sing, and because not only that, his voice is exceptional, and that's why people go out of their way to help him, but also coupled with love. I mean, it's interesting that the priest never became selfish and didn't try and keep him in Belfast for himself. He realised that what he'd started was this journey for this incredible young person, and he knew that Fergal was going to go on to greater and greater things, and he did what a proper lover should do, which is to truly love him, is to let him go, and he did. I'm in the middle of writing the sequel right now, because Fergal's now moved to Rome and is studying to be an opera singer. And, you know, will Father Mac reappear? We'll see. But yeah, there's a question mark towards the end of the story. But I mean, I think Fergal is the kind of person that when he gets older, he'll look back on his life, even though he's a fictional character, he'll look back on his life and think to himself, that was one of the great loves.
Your work, basically, is as a live performer of traditional Irish music as well as your own. But having witnessed you a couple of times on stage here at the Queensland Irish Club,
yes,
it's not really the platform for you to deal with the issues that you might like people to be aware of.
Well, do you know, as funny as it may sound, although I'm very public about my work and about my performance, and I get up on stage for a living and ask for people's attention, I am also kind of private too. It depends on who I'm with, who I'm talking to. If I honestly had a lover right now, depending on the lover, of course, I would be probably quite shy about talking about it and talking about details. And, you know, my intimate life is one of the only things I have left that's private. So as much as I poke fun at it, and I am a confident person, there's no doubt about that, and I love to talk about subjects that are difficult, because I think if you don't talk about things, they don't get any better. I'm not one for kind of coming out on a grand scale. I'm not one for shouting from the rooftops. However, these days, because of my little modicum of fame in Ireland, I understood very clearly that it was important to stand beside it, at least, and be responsible for who you are, because, you know, so much of the difficulty in being gay comes from being invisible. And I didn't quite understand that, you know, there'd be a family in the middle of Ireland whose mother and father had been to see me play live and had met me at a signing. And so, therefore, I was already in their lives from a musical point of view. And then maybe later on, one of their children might be gay. And how difficult it is for that subject to come up. And then maybe they might find out that I am. And then if they can see a happy, healthy gay man out there just, you know, being an entertainer and a writer and being a successful person, that it's not this kind of, you know, social death sentence or cultural death sentence, you know, that it can be actually a great thing.
And also it can be a thing that doesn't have to define their whole lives. They just happen to like people of the same sex. And what else? So what?
That was This Way Out correspondent John Frame in conversation with Irish singer and now with the arrival of Fergal Flynn novelist Brian Kennedy.
I love you as I've never loved before. Since first I saw you on the village green. Come to me. My dreams of love are warm. Oh, I love you as I loved you when you were sweet, when you were sweet. 16.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Christopher Gall, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, and John Frame contributed program material. Thanks also to Curtis Crick. Brian Kennedy sang When You Were Sweet 16, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. You can also email tworadio@aol.com to ask for our monthly This Way Out updates and or to receive our weekly program promo messages. This Way Out is supported by charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. Please find out how you can help keep us on the air and get our tangible thanks by visiting our website. And to be sure you don't miss a week of This Way Out, you can subscribe to audio CDs of our program. For all the details, please do log on to thiswayout.org, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WDIY, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Aero FM, Masterton, New Zealand, KOOP, Austin, Texas, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody's going to stay tuned. We'll be right back.